Hey, Wesley.
Yes, Jenna.
Guess what treasure I found in my inbox not too long ago?
Oh, I don't know. You might just have to tell me what it is.
Okay. A listener named Salome sent a really nice message. Can I read it to you?
Oh, as long as it's good, I'll take it.
Yeah, it's really good. Dear Jenna. Oh, I love this. Just the formality. Oh, I love it. Please excuse my having slid into your DMs to ask you about this. You are excused. Thank you for the politeness. If this is not okay, please let me know. Again, Wesley, we love consent in this household.
Consent.
I was late to find you on Wesley's podcast. It is such a balm to the confusion with which I would previously traverse the world. Do you ever both go back to your previous podcasts in new light? I've just finished listening to Psycho Bros. And it is so timely that it's after Harry Styles' Vogue cover blew open that conversation with my friends. I'd be so interested to hear your thoughts on how his expression of masculinity feeds into your previous conversation. Thanks in advance, and again, for articulating the things that discomfort so many people.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Salome. I mean, the first thing I'll say is I'm for the Vogue cover. I'm for all Harry Styles looks. He can serve it.
And I love the image of Harry in that field, shot by Tyler Mitchell, playing with balloons. Just to me, it feels like releasing of the farcical ideas of the gender binary and the roles that we get really boxed into as life goes on. It feels like reverting to something more playful. And I just needed that. When that cover came out, it felt so like a breath of fresh air.
You just don't expect it. You know, that video for Walk Through Fire or whatever that song is called, where he's like running around that fishing village.
Adore you.
He's just running around this fishing village in just Gucci glamour, but having all
head
these, you know, sexy longshoremen just be like, what is going on here? And he's like, it's normal, guys. Don't worry about it. We're going to get this fish back into the ocean. I love that video. And I love Harry Styles.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Does it seem like he's like pretending or putting it on?
No. Oh, my God. No. It feels soft and expansive and invigorating in this way where, I mean, do I wish that the face of gender fluidity was not a cis male white pop star? Yes. If it has to be, and we're talking the cover of Vogue, am I mad that it's Harry Styles? No. Harry Styles is definitely, you know, very soft in this way where he can, you know, allow us to think more expansively and more softly about what it means to be a man in 2020 into 2021, which is clearly a conversation the entire world needs to be having, and to stop holding on so tightly to whatever those expectations and ideas are.
And the occasion for this conversation is that we're in the middle of making some new episodes. They're coming in March. And we just don't like the idea of a dry ass feed.
Mm-mm.
And while we're making some new episodes, we figure we'd repopulate our stream with some oldies but goodies. You know, massage some Aquaphor on what we got going. So what we've got are some of your favorite episodes and a couple of our favorite episodes. And now, without further ado, Psycho Bros. Years ago, I was just out of college and I was getting mail to my house.
It's the most adult feeling in the world.
And I got a copy of this Rolling Stone from October of 1999. And it is ostensibly a profile of Brad Pitt conducted by the great profile writer Chris Heath. Mm. He's just following Brad around Europe, asking him a bunch of annoying questions, like whether he's smart, his relationship with Jennifer Aniston, how he feels about fame, trying to get to the heart and the soul of who Brad Pitt is. that interview in Rolling Stone came with some very appealing packaging. And what I'm talking about is in the cover photography by Mark Seliger. And it is essentially Brad Pitt reclining on one of those, like, in the middle of the house fireplaces. And he's just reclining there and looking up at the camera.
Central.
AKA you and me. His hair is shorn. He's got one hand up near his mouth holding a cigarette. And the other is just sort of by his side. His legs are apart. And the reason to bring that up is because Brad Pitt isn't wearing a pair of shorts or pants. The man is in a mini dress.
Stop.
Yes!
I love it. I'm very into this pose. I'm very into these thighs, this arm. I'm very into this dress. He's got one orange rubber glove on. And then next to him, there's this like papaya-shaped ashtray. Very, very vaginal. Very Georgia O'Keeffe. I mean, I have to imagine that's a very unusual image of a man, let alone the man of America at that moment in time, Brad Pitt, to be out there in the world. I mean, how did it feel? How did people respond?
Well, it wasn't as though a picture of a man like this would be that rare. I mean, it was rare, but it's either black men who everybody had sort of written off as weird anyway, like Dennis Rodman, or it was like a fractured weirdo like Kurt Cobain. This was a seemingly stable, healthy, average cis male white guy who was also at that point the apotheosis or an apotheosis of where masculinity seemed to be going. Mm. Brad Pitt had played a bunch of psychos at that point. He became famous for seducing Gina Davis on the run from the law in Thelma and Louise, giving her the best and possibly only orgasm of her life, then stealing her money. And now he's on the cover of this magazine in this dress, and my mind was blown.
Yeah, my mind is blown looking at it today. It's amazing.
I felt real scrambled. And part of the scrambling was that I felt like that image and the person in it were trying to tell me something. Like, what else a man could be? Like, there's this other way. There's this other way to express masculinity that is both incorporating all of the traditional ideas that we have, but also to, like, turn it into something weird and fun and comical and like slightly threatening.
But the idea that someone like Brad Pitt would be comfortable skewering and filling out and adding to ideas of masculinity in this extraordinarily public form and forum, while also being at the same time in a film that's very much about the ways in which masculinity gets twisted and warped and is up for analyzing as well, is like, so, I mean, even now, 20 years later, sitting here, it feels very radical.
Yeah. And from Brad Pitt, by the way, who 20 years after this picture gets taken, is still near the center of American culture, messing with our ideas of masculinity and what a man is and who else a man could be.
What was so exciting to me about re-encountering this image, you know, Brad Pitt represents an idealized version of American masculinity. So for him to feel so stable in that identity that he can totally play around with it, queer it, you know, we didn't have the language around his hacking, I guess, that we do now.
So
it's really exciting to think about this conversation that he started 20 some years ago that we're still having today.
I would say that we are finally ready to be having.
Well, we finally caught up to that image. It took 20 years, but we finally caught up to that image. I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
This is Still Processing.
Jenna, I need to tell you something.
Okay, I'm all ears.
I am a little concerned about our use of the term toxic masculinity. I feel like it's sort of misapplied to a lot of different things.
As many things are, yes.
Conventionally, toxic masculinity is referring to, among other things, the suppression of vulnerability in boys and men, their ability to express a range of emotions and not just two or three, and those two or three emotions being sort of on the negative end of human self-expression. I don't know. I feel like it now gets applied to any sort of male behavior that seems questionable.
Right. I mean, I think traditionally toxic masculinity, when people employ it correctly, is used to talk about the ways in which male privilege and male power is used to threaten, harm, oppress, extinguish, you know, any other form of selfhood or expression. I think it's also employed any time men behave badly. It's kind of become a catch-all term for any expression of maleness or masculinity.
Yeah. And so 20 years ago, I mean, the term existed, but we weren't using it willy-nilly the way we are now. But, you know, we had this conversation about this Brad Pitt picture from 1999. The picture was timed to the release of Fight Club, the movie in which he stars as this. I'm sorry if you didn't know this already, but
spoiler alert for a movie that's been out 20 years.
The manifestation of another character's masculinity crisis, essentially.
Ooh, yes.
And the movie is like a complete exploration into whatever that term actually means and is doing. So Fight Club, starring Brad Pitt and Edward Norton and Helena Bonham Carter, comes out in 1999, in the fall of 99, and is the story of this sort of cubicle jockey sort of person who works for a car company and does the recall evaluations so that when there's an accident, he goes to the scene, evaluates the scene, sees how bad the accident is, and sort of does a bunch of algorithmic-like equations to determine whether or not this car or this model needs to be recalled.
Mm.
And something about that job, which does involve violence, it does involve a kind of moral corruption.
It does also involve a degree of dissociation from, like, the trauma and death and destruction that you're looking at every day. And so as a result, he's anesthetized, you know, he's completely numbed out.
And so there's this combination of things that happens between this job where he's required to compartmentalize his humanity in one sense and his reaping the rewards of that compartmentalization as an American consumer. So he's buying all this stuff and he's filling his condo with all these wonderful things, which in the mind of this movie, which David Fincher directed, is IKEA stuff.
Like so many others, I had become a slave to the IKEA nesting instinct.
But remember back then, though, IKEA was this, like, rare, exciting thing.
If I saw something clever, like a little coffee table in the shape of a yin-yang, I had to have it.
It wasn't as broadly available as it is today.
I treated
that
catalog
exciting.
Like a Bible.
It's like, ooh, IKEA, you know?
And the Rizlampa wire lamps of environmentally friendly unbleached paper.
So at some point, the movie is bringing IKEA catalogs to life.
The Hovatrack home exerbike.
You're sort of like moving through this like David Fincher produced showroom of
human life, right. Idealized human existence.
I had it all, even the glass dishes with tiny bubbles and imperfections, proof that they were crafted by the honest, simple, hardworking indigenous peoples of wherever.
There are many scenes in this movie in which the narrator, whose name we never learn, he is describing the perfectly normal way in which our relationship to capitalism begets this kind of spiritual numbness.
Mm.
And during this sort of laying out of a consumerist world, something in him is snapping. And he is, in this period, going to all these self-help groups and touring other people's trauma and damage, much the way that he does in his professional life. He's sort of a tourist of accidents that he must assess the value of for his company or the harm potentially being done to his company. And in his private life, he is touring the harms that other people are living through every day. But he's kind of mocking it too, right? He's kind of laughing at these people.
You think so?
I mean, I think that the way he explains it to us is that, you know, I actually get something out of this, which is I feel healthier being around all these unhealthy people.
Interesting. See, I've always read it as he can't access any suffering in his own life. Like, he doesn't feel good. He doesn't feel well. He doesn't know why. And the only way to access any emotion on the human spectrum is to try on other people's unhappiness and other people's suffering.
Yes.
It's a cosplay for him.
But there is this interest in having some salve for this unspecified pain. Mm-hmm. And at some point, not too far into the movie, whatever this pain is, this frustration that comes out of going to all these sort of self-help groups mm-hmm. and group therapies, creates this alternative self that looks like Brad Pitt, dresses like, I don't even know, like an LA hippie circa 1995. It's like if Bex Odelay could walk and talk, that's what that guy's dressed like.
Okay.
So he shows up. He says his name is Tyler Durden. And something about him and how cool he seems speaks to Edward Norton's character. And he's just automatically readable as this manifestation of an idealized man for this guy.
Brad Pitt in his best role ever. I mean, I definitely think that Ed Norton's character, who's unnamed, the narrator, is going through, as you mentioned, a spiritual crisis. He is lacking a feeling of belonging. And it definitely feels indicative of a cultural moment of the time. You know, that profile, which I reread recently, they interview Ed Norton, and he talks a lot about how there was this perception that people of his generation were very much aligned with like a Reality Bites type of ennui, just like this kind of driftless, aimless generation that's like unhappy, but like really depressed. And then Norton was like, you know, that was not exactly our story. For the rest of us, there was kind of like this sort of disgust with American capitalism, this sort of discernment and worry about the future of society, and just feeling like things are really messed up. You know, they're really messed up and we're unhappy, and there is this kind of simmering discontentment. And Ed Norton's character is someone who also doesn't have a relationship to masculinity or the idea of manhood. And so as he's going through, you know, the motions of his life, and he experiences this mental break, and then Tyler Durden emerges, he's infatuated with this man, because it seems like at first Tyler Durden is a very interesting guy, obviously very handsome, you know, has a very interesting moral core and ethos, and knows himself,
right,
understands how he wants to be in space as a man, which is something that Ed Norton's character has never figured out. And so when you encounter these two characters, you feel like, you know, at first, Tyler Durden is going to be the Sherpa into this new world and this new identity that Ed Norton doesn't need these help groups anymore. He doesn't need to rely on this sort of depressing end of the spectrum of human experiences to feel whole, that now he has kind of this guide who's going to teach him, you know, a bit about how to fill out his own skin for himself.
Right, right.
And that's where things get interesting.
What do you want me to do? You just want me to hit you?
Come on. Do me this one favor.
Why?
Why? I don't know why. Never been in a fight. You?
No, but that's a good thing.
No, it is not. How much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? I don't want to die without any scars.
And they fight.
Oh. Motherfucker! You hit me in the ear!
Well, Jesus, I'm sorry.
Ow! Christ!
I mean, I remember when I first saw this movie, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. I was definitely a kid who, like, wore JNCOs and went on like Warped Tour. So for me, I was just like, yeah, like I was like very into this idea of embracing a counterculture narrative, like rejecting capitalist norms. You know, I was obsessed with that magazine Adbusters. Like I was really into this idea that, like, you know, we don't have to be fed ideas of how to live, and like just not buying into this idea of some pyramid of success. So back then, you know, I was really seeing it as, I mean, we all were. We were seeing it as this critique of consumerism and our money-obsessed world. And now when I watch it, you know, I really see it more as a critique of masculinity. And I think I just didn't have the vocabulary to understand it then.
Like, none of the speeches necessarily are about men and masculinity. I mean, we don't think about men sort of being made to be marriageable in the way that women have been socialized to be marriageable. Mm. But this is also a guy who at this point in his life, he would have been like about 30. He's got a good job. He's attractive enough. He should have a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. He should be shopping for a ring somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that the split happens in a weird way, that Tyler is the manifestation of a thing that would make him unmarriageable.
Ooh.
At some point, the narrator loses his condo, has nowhere to live. He's homeless. And so Tyler invites him into his giant, if you had to draw a picture of what a cancer house would look like, it would be this place.
Most of the windows were boarded up. There was no lock on the front door from when the police or whoever kicked it in. Stairs were ready to collapse.
Where everybody that comes near it goes in, it seems sick. Everybody's smoking all the time. The faucets are like, do you want to drink the water? Is anything in this house clean? Every inch of this house is filthy. It's scuzzy. It's dirty. It's never been disinfected. And nothing about it is a place you'd want to bring anybody that you want to have a relationship with.
It's so true.
It is sort of a guarantee against being included in society. It's only a place where you build some sort of counterculture.
It's totally a flop house.
Right. I mean, it's even worse than that. I mean, the house itself is toxic.
The big reveal in Fight Club, of course, is that Tyler Durden and Ed Norton's character, who's unnamed, are the same person. And back then, you're watching the movie, and it's this big twist. It's this reveal. It's like this very clever, you know, plot moment. But we're also talking about someone that has a mental illness, right? Like, we're talking about someone who has maybe what we would call dissociative disorder, split personalities, borderline personalities. I don't know. He's wrestling with himself in a very unhealthy and unhinged way. You know, the movie kind of makes it seem like the alt personality, the alt ego, is what allows him to come into himself more and understand himself more and embody a type of freedom that he hasn't ever experienced before. But we're also talking about a mental illness. And so it's very interesting that the movie is embracing the expression, the hyper-aggressive expression of masculinity as a mental illness.
Right. And that the manifestation of that mental illness is like what I can only describe as a psycho bro.
Right.
You know, where the only healthy outlet of that masculinity is violence and rejection. And it's funny because, you know, they establish this fight club and the club is men coming to beat each other senseless. And I was sort of struck by where that impulse comes from, right? They feel like this is what they deserve. You know, there's something about watching these guys beat each other up and be exhilarated by it. But there's also nothing that feels good in it for you and me as people watching this behavior.
It's completely fascinating that the alternate reality that they imagine for themselves that exists outside of heteronormativity, so marriage, kids, all those things, is just pure violence. Like, they could have decided to can food. They could have decided to make quilts. They could have decided to start a farm. No, they decide to blow up buildings and wreak havoc on the world.
Right.
But it's really interesting that in rejecting kind of the ways in which men are expected to show up in society, they create this hyper-violent version of selfhood. That is their version of masculinity that I guess apparently this movie thinks is inherent in all men, or at least these men.
Well, there's also this other amazing moment that happens maybe a quarter of the way through the movie where Edward Norton and Brad Pitt are in the bathroom together. And Brad Pitt's in the tub and Edward Norton's like facing away from Brad Pitt as he bathes. And Brad Pitt's character has this rag over his face. Mm-hmm. And Tyler keeps asking the narrator, if you could fight anybody, well,
who would you fight? Fight my boss, probably.
Really?
Yeah, why? Who would you fight?
Fight my dad.
I don't know my dad.
My dad never went to college. So it's real important that I go.
That sounds familiar.
So I graduate, I call him up long distance, I said, Dad, now what? He says, I don't know, get married.
I mean, you can't get married. I'm a 30-year-old boy.
We're a generation of men raised by women. I'm wondering if another woman is really the answer we need.
And so you're just kind of like, yeah, they are very aware that they're a bunch of Adams who no longer need any Eves.
Yeah.
And the idea that that mental illness also manifests this misogyny is also, like, what do you do with that? And I would say that that is a thing the culture is doing right now in general. When you get a depiction of maleness and masculinity now, you tend to see what I'm just going to keep describing as a psycho bro. And one of the biggest hits of the year, is Joker.
Yeah.
About the psychoist bro.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
My name is Thomas Gibbons-Neff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So fast forward 20 years to October 2019. A little film called Joker comes out. It takes place in the Batman universe. It centers on the backstory, the origin story of Joker, who everybody knows. If you've ever read a Batman comic or seen the cartoon or seen any of the Dark Knight movies, you know Joker looms large. And Joaquin Phoenix is cast as the central character. So there was this idea of getting a sense at sort of the psychology of someone who plays pranks and is this arch nemesis to one of the greatest comic book characters, you know, ever invented, Batman. And so trying to figure out what makes him tick started to really stir people up.
My mother always tells me to smile and put on a happy face.
But then the trailer comes out.
She told me I had a purpose. To bring laughter and joy to the world.
And the trailer paints a picture of a very lonely, isolated, alienated white dude. And people kind of start being like,
freaking out.
Who is this movie for? And right. What exactly is this movie about? And so that entire cloud hangs over the film from the moment it's announced to the first screenings into the success of the film, because it does remarkably well in the theaters, right?
Yes, it is the biggest October opening ever.
Wow.
And it's also a comic book movie. Like those things,
right.
You just, you know, all you got to do is say Joaquin Phoenix is going to put on some clown makeup and read the phone book.
Totally.
It makes $100 million the first weekend.
I used to think that my life was a tragedy. Now I realize it's a comedy.
But, you know, because we're living in a moment where we're trying to untangle this notion of white nationalism, we're trying to understand the ways in which it's manifesting in all of these shootings that are happening around the country. We're trying to understand how it ties into these outbursts of violence as the direct result of feeling, you know, quote unquote, left out of some bigger cultural narrative.
Right. Yes.
So Joker became emblematic of this sentiment.
Right.
So all eyes are on this film. But what we really get is a movie about a very unwell individual.
I don't like Joker, but one of the few things that are interesting about this movie is the way that it is explicit about all the things that are implicit in Fight Club. And this is a guy, his name is Arthur Fleck. The job that pays him money is being a clown on the street, handing out flyers basically and doing sandwich board style work to try to get people to go to businesses in the Times Square area. But what he really aspires to do is stand-up comedy. And throughout the film, he is actively trying to do the things that the men, or particularly the narrator in Fight Club, is actively rejecting, which is being a good partner and trying to get stability, period.
Yeah.
These are all things Joker is in pursuit of, like the attainment of all kinds of stability, class stability, mental stability, job security.
I mean, everything that Tyler Durden rejects, Joker wants for himself. You know, he wants the steady girlfriend. He wants the income. And when he can't get them, it sort of drives him to the breaking point
right.
at which Joker starts to emerge.
Right. I'm trying to be the man society says I should be. And
exactly.
at every turn, you tell me I can't.
Exactly.
Snap.
Right.
Society's collapse affects him. And part of his illness is that he doesn't think that anybody can see him and that he doesn't matter. Which, you know, for any non-white person in the audience, you just kind of want to have a little chuckle.
Mm-hmm.
Sir, the whole thing is set up to see you.
Yeah.
But it does begin to collapse. And, you know, he's seeing a social worker that he can't see anymore. He loses his job. So therefore, he loses his access to healthcare and therefore his access to pharmaceuticals.
Right.
So he's off his meds. He doesn't have therapy anymore. And however stable he was begins to fracture.
Right, right. I did like Joker because, I don't know, as someone who really also struggles with a lot of anxiety and depression, I was really happy to see a portrayal of just the difficulties of day-to-day life
mm-hmm.
when you are not feeling well. However, the entire movie sets you up for this transformation that's about to happen from regular degular guy into supervillain. And I think the whole movie kind of uses the fact that he has this undisclosed mental unwellness. They sort of set it up as, well, he can't help himself.
Right.
You know, that's how they explain away the Joker laugh. That's how they explain away some of his delusional behavior. And it felt like a really lazy shorthand for, like, he can't help what he's about to do. Like, none of these things are his fault because he's mentally sick. But it's also not an excuse for the violence that he's about to descend to, the killing that he does, the way he treats people around him. It really enraged me, actually.
I hear you. But then there's this other thing that the movie does, which is treat masculinity as a mental illness.
Right.
Which here results in the creation of a relationship with the woman who lives down the hall, who's played by Zazie Beetz.
Mm-hmm.
And she's his girlfriend in his mind. For the movie.
Right.
And she does all the things that he thinks a girlfriend ought to do, which is basically sit around while you suffer and
rub your back.
And rub your back. Exactly.
Right. It's interesting because so many of his behaviors, his socially unacceptable behaviors, again, are explained away by his mental illness. You know, after he has this interaction with Zazie Beetz's character in the elevator, he stalks her. And he imagines that she's amused by it or charmed by it or turned on by it. But in actuality, we don't even know if that happens or how she feels about it. But again, it just kind of allows all of this unacceptable social behavior to bloom under the disguise of, well, he can't be helped. You know, he can't help himself because he's not well.
Right.
You know, in the same way that Fight Club seemed to speak to a type of malaise of a generation, if we're thinking about Joker as potentially speaking to a sentiment shared by, I don't know, young men in this country and the world, it kind of feels like an extension of like boys will be boys logic.
Oh, yeah.
That,
like
anything's
yeah.
okay because you're unhappy.
It's funny how Gotham City in this movie functions the way the house does in Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gotham City is also this scuzzy, chaotic, dirty place where the presiding patriarchal energy is basically Thomas Wayne, who's the father of Bruce Wayne, who'll become Batman. And this idea that, you know, in Fight Club, those guys are rejecting that. The house is a haven away from all of this sort of billionaire, corporate, consumerist, capitalist corruption and pollution, whereas in Gotham, it's still a thing that Arthur wants to ascribe himself within. You know, he at some point gets in his mind that Thomas Wayne, Bruce Wayne's father,
mm-hmm.
is his dad too. And the idea that the father is rejecting the son who isn't really his son, it, all the sour notes you hit to create a person who's going to explode in a fit of unwellness and, mm-hmm. and psycho bro behavior, but like, what are the trigger points that lead a person like this to madness? It is this narcissism that craves attention. It's the like starvation for parental affection and approval. It's the anger at not being taken seriously or believed. His masculinity is being affronted by all of this rejection and mockery and laughter and dismissal.
Mm. And I think that the Joker represents a lot of men in our culture who feel that their interests are no longer represented, or that their ideas are no longer valuable, or that people are no longer interested in them simply because they are white men.
Well, you know, this Arthur Fleck Joker character is, I would say he's at the bottom of society in some ways, or the movie would argue that he's on the bottom.
I mean, I think that's why the movie has raised such a cultural alarm, is that, you know, historically, I feel like Gotham has kind of functioned as a petri dish for the worst case scenario of humanity. It's a fictional version of New York City within which things have deteriorated so much. You know, the city is in such decline, there's such economic ruin that you get this generation of superheroes that have to emerge to deal with the problems because the state has failed the people so much.
Anyway, I would just say that there is unwellness at every price point at this particular cultural moment. It's not just people on the bottom or people who think they're on the bottom or people in the middle. It's people all the way at the top.
Yeah.
On Succession, HBO Succession, there's a guy named Kendall Roy who could be Bruce Wayne, but is really, really suffering way more than Bruce ever suffered.
He could also be Joker. He could be on the cusp of becoming a Joker.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that in a second. We'll be right back. The show, HBO Succession, it is a drama. It is a satire. It's a little bit of a thriller. And the show is basically about who's going to run the company, because daddy's dying, who's going to succeed him. Logan Roy is the patriarch of this family and the CEO of this mega company. And the three kids are, I mean, they're basically useless, right? There's a woman named Siobhan, everybody calls Shiv, although she doesn't do enough shivving for me as far as I'm concerned.
I know. It's hilarious that her nickname is Shiv and she hasn't quite figured out how to
use
Shiv.
The knife. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's Roman Roy, who's the youngest kid and kind of feckless, but knows it, right? He knows he might be the most abused of the three kids because the father, Logan, not terribly affectionate, not terribly loving. It's something that this show has in common with both Fight Club and with Joker, this disconnection among children and their parents. Mm. But Succession is really about the struggle of these grown-ass kids, by the way, to get their father to notice and acknowledge them and to, like, reward them, I think in some ways out of entitlement, but also kind of, like, as reparation for the harm that he has caused them over their childhoods. The thing about Succession that fascinates me is Kendall. Mostly because it seems like he's passive, but in some other world, this guy would be running Waystar Royco. But at some point, in Logan's telling Kendall that he just can't be CEO, the reason that he explains that he can't run the company is because he's not man enough to do it.
Mm. I'm going to give it a couple of years.
As in?
I'll stay in situ as chairman, CEO, head of the firm.
Dad, what?
It just said, son, or we're not listening as usual.
But I'm, you're not, what?
It's no big deal. I'm staying on. We can discuss the details.
You didn't tell me.
We can announce you're in pole position, pending events, a move up or whatever.
Pending events?
Okay, come on, let's eat.
Kendall, of course, he goes through this cycle of entitlement to run the company. Uncertainty that he will be chosen to run the company, and then determination to prove to his father that he is indeed worthy of running the company.
Right.
The way he's performed by Jeremy Strong, the actor who plays him, is like he's very sort of uptight. He's battling drug addiction, but Kendall's attempts to rehabilitate himself come in from mockery from Logan Roy, the patriarch of the family, because these attempts to better himself are deemed soft. They're deemed weak. His attempt to kick his substance abuse habits are unmanly. Because a real man, presumably, would just deal with it.
Interesting.
He'd be able to function in the world without getting any outside help or having to confess anything.
Right.
Or share in a group any of the problems that he's dealing with. And like a lifetime of that for Kendall has created this completely warped idea of what a man is and how a man is supposed to behave. in two seasons of TV, how many different kinds of men has he, how many different kind of bros has he been? He's been a tech bro. He's been a biz bro. You know, he's the guy that you can imagine being in Tyler Durden's Fight Club.
Oh, yeah. He would definitely start the New York chapter for sure. But I'm really fascinated by the role that Shiv occupies within the family. It's really interesting to watch how being around all of this masculinity that is, I think, very toxic and very mentally unwell influences her and shapes her as a woman, as a person. I mean, she has to be around all these men by just a sheer function of the work that she does and her wanting to be involved in the family business. But she doesn't really know how to function.
Also, management training program, Roman COO, you have a toddler with a hard-on for chief operating officer and I'm going through a management training program?
You're a young woman with no experience.
A woman, that's a minus.
Well, of course it's a fucking minus. I didn't make the world.
Oh, Jesus Christ, Dad.
She feels like the product of growing up in a world tainted by a very unhealthy view of masculinity. I mean, she cannot figure out her identity because she's entrenched in this family and because she wants to play the game, but also because the things that give her an advantage is that being a woman, being a well-spoken woman, being someone who has experience in the public realm as like a political strategist, it's like she never wants to use her womanness to her advantage. Mm-hmm. It's like she's too busy sort of trying to figure out the most masculine version of herself to sort of be able to contend with her brothers and her father. And she thinks that maybe she has to be a little bit more like them mm-hmm. in order to get ahead. It's a meditation on the ways in which damaged men damage the world around them. And
right.
the casualty is just a woman like Shiv.
What we're talking about with Succession and Joker and Fight Club is this belief that you kind of secretly don't deserve what you have or that you shouldn't have what you have and that we're only talking about white men. Like this combination of displacement and disenfranchisement and the fear that you might be irrelevant, but also stuck in place, with this combination of some higher power that is aware of your like wanting to be either where they are or you're wanting more for yourself or you're actually being lost. This higher power is aware of all that and kind of wants to exploit it and use it against you. And it creates this really interesting sort of psychological and moral high pressure system that in just talking to you about it just reminded me of Cambridge Analytica, right? There's this new book out by this guy named Christopher Wiley, and it's about his time at Cambridge Analytica, and it's called Mindfucker. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the book is doing is going through the ways in which this company mined people's Facebook data courtesy of these personality quizzes. And the research being done with this data pointed out who among the participants mm-hmm. was susceptible to certain ideas based on, I don't know, whether they demonstrated signs of paranoid ideation or other kinds of mental unwellness. And Christopher Wiley actually talked to Terry Gross about this on her show Fresh Air not that long ago.
Steve Bannon, you know, discovered that there's nothing more powerful than a humiliated man. And that, you know, when you looked at a lot of the narratives that emerged, there were groups of typically heterosexual white men who sort of felt that because they could no longer be, quote unquote, a real man, they couldn't show who they, quote unquote, felt like they really were. They almost felt closeted. And when you have, you know, people who feel like they're being oppressed, even if it's a misperception of oppression, that's a really powerful force.
With that data, you had a demographic that could be marketed to, right? Mm-hmm. You could feed them disinformation. You could supply them with racist ideology, and it would fuel them, and they would be very receptive to it. But essentially, Cambridge Analytica was exploiting these vulnerabilities that, yeah, people didn't even know that they mm-hmm. had.
Mm-hmm. We should say, though, that Cambridge Analytica was basically purchased by the billionaire Republican donor, Robert Mercer, mm-hmm. and Steve Bannon, who wound up being one of the, advisor. Like a senior advisor at the White House for President Trump. And they were using the data that they had to basically turn some of these men into soldiers for this social extremist ideology that taps into these ideas of white supremacy, white nationalism, white power. But the idea that's fueling it is this notion of endangerment, this notion of displacement, what Brad Pitt basically says some version of to Edward Norton in the bathtub, which is that, you know, we were all raised by these crazy feminists, and now they want to take over and displace us. And that is the sort of guiding ideology that we are now in some ways building guys who are sort of marching in lockstep into some sort of ideological fight club.
Right.
It also is nuts to think about, this is going to be crazy, but it's occurring to me as I'm talking to you that, you know, part of Brad Pitt's Brad Pittness and the thing that's fascinating about his being the manifestation of this character's, of this other character's psychological break with reality in some ways is that he is, in the minds of many people, a perfect specimen. Right? This unattainable, I mean, whatever we mean by whatever an incel is, like, it's the person, like, they're seeing Brad Pitt, the person they know that they can't actually physically manifest themselves as being, is this thing that is ultimately unattainable.
The unattainability of idealness becomes the sickness itself, you know? And yeah. I mean, all of these cultural properties that we're talking about employ a type of fantasy of masculinity as something to strive for and as something to try to achieve. And the reason that we're obsessed with these cultural properties is because we're living at a moment in time where we understand that men feel disenfranchised, specifically white men. We understand that there's a particular type of predilection towards violence that we don't understand. And we want to understand it because it's kind of ruining our lives. It's ruining the planet. It's ruining the economy. It's ruining the social fabric of our society. And so we want to understand it too, because we're deeply invested in figuring out if there's some way to course correct, if there's some corrective poultice that we can apply as a society to try to heal. But I think the truth is that in the same way very much that it makes women very sick, I mean, I'm speaking in a very binary way, but I think it makes women very ill to try to achieve some sort of archetype of femininity that's not about them or was not created with them in mind. It seems that men suffer from the same ailment as well. It's just manifesting in these very different ways. But it definitely seems like Fight Club is still the perfect analogy for our times, because in the process of trying to ideate or iterate yourself into a perfect man, aka Tyler Durden / Brad Pitt, you lose yourself.
Yeah.
And you get very sick in the process.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It is produced by Nina Patak.
Our editor is Sarah Saracen, and we get editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin.
Our engineer is Jake Gorski.
And our theme music's by Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness.
You can find all of our episodes and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing.
And if you are so inclined, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you.